Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. For those of our listeners in the United States, we hope you have had a rich and reflective Memorial Day, that you have cherished this moment with friends and family that was bought for you by those who sacrificed their future for this present. For those U.S. listeners and for our listeners abroad, whose days of memoriam fall at different times during the year, I bid you take a moment out after this podcast, or sometime during the day, to consider our forebears who paid so mightily for our liberty. The casual opinion, the stray song, trusting a neighbor, and so many other subtle freedoms we find natural enough as to be imperceptible during our waking hours. These daily joys were bought for us in blood. In our milieu of discussion about innovation, strategy, and security, we must never lose sight of the horrors and humanity of conflict underlying so many of these subjects. In fact, let you and I take that moment right now, 30 seconds out of our day, if you're working out, commuting, or just listening as you sit on your couch, 30 seconds for us to consider the immense sacrifice that was required just so we could have this moment of reflection. Thank you. And may this be a small part of what is a greater reflection on the sacrifices made and the liberties gained by those who gave it all. Now, this week's podcast is your monthly installment of Sea Control East Atlantic by our friends from the Phoenix Think Tank. Today, Alex Clark brings us the first of a series of panels on defense issues from across the pond, or in Alex's case, right there. Or here, if you're listening over there. Alex and his three guests will discuss the state of NATO's defense spending and whether or not it is sufficient to face today's expanding threats. We will join Alex and company for this discussion right after a short break.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific Edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.
Hello and welcome to another edition of East Atlantic Sea Control. This will be with our usual panel, which we're just starting up. Usually we will have another gentleman called Felix joining us from Germany, but unfortunately he's busy tonight. So tonight it'll be me, Alexander Clark, and three of our newly regular panelists, Chris, Paul, and Arrigo. And let's start off with the Italian stallion, Arrigo. Please introduce yourself.
I am Arrigo. I am PhD from King's College. My field of research is naval history, naval security, and combined operation.
Thank you. Paul, how about you next?
Hello, this is Paul Fisher. I'm retired Royal Navy commander. I live in the south of France now, and my interest is in strategy and naval futures.
Oh, cool. And Chris?
Thank you, Alexander. I'm Chris Stockdale. I've got a Master's in Applied Strategy and International Security, and I'm Associate Editor and UK Chapter President for the Centre for International Maritime Security.
Thank you. And hello, my name's Alex Clark. I have been given this job of hosting these podcasts by SimSec, and I work because of it's a joint effort with the PTT, and I do it because I enjoy it. And I have got a PhD from King's College London in the War Studies Department, where I studied alongside Arrigo. It was on the Royal Navy in the 1920s and 30s, but I have written widely on lots of other stuff as it's come along. The topic for tonight is maritime security, and has NATO's members cut too far in a world of growing and diversifying threats? So, to start off with, I thought I'd ask the question, what are the threats? And who would like to go first? I'm going to just nominate Paul, because...
I thought that might happen. in terms of... I'll limit this to maritime threats, and I think possibly we ought to limit it to within what used to be NATO's area of interest, and I'm talking about the North Atlantic. So that would include Mediterranean, North Atlantic, North Sea, round to the north of Russia. And I think, although it hasn't happened yet, I think that there is a latent piracy threat. Although in that particular, if you bound that area like that, it's not obvious at the moment. I don't think it'll be, it could be piracy slant terrorist threat. Let's put it like that. A non-national maritime originated threat is a possibility. And I think then, these are in no order of priority, I think there is certainly an emergent Russian capability, which is starting to become apparent. And I think slightly longer term, there is the potential, and this is really sticking my neck out, for deployments of Iranian, Indian and Chinese maritime capability. This may be a small chance, but I think longer term it may well become a reality as those regional powers decide to demonstrate their reach. So that's where I'll kick it off with, just those things.
How about Arrigo? Would you like to elaborate on that or raise your own points?
I think Paul nailed the main problem. We have a lot of growing threats, so more interesting than other, and a sort of, I would say, cloudy idea of what a threat is. We have just talked about piracy, or latent piracy, or deployment of regional power forces in our main area of interest, and traditional personal force threat coming from Russia. But how realistic are those threats? Russia, we can see, Mr. Putin is becoming more and more aggressive. Piracy. North Atlantic piracy, even Caribbean piracy, I think, is a thing of the past. But Mediterranean piracy can become quite powerful, or at least threatening. About China and India coming in our water, I am quite friendly with Chinese officers, so I think it's not such a big threat. And it's what we are doing almost every week with Royal Navy, US Navy, and even Italian Navy, deploying small surface force in their own yard. So we cannot simply say, oh, it's a threat. But, yeah. We live in a crowded part of this watery planet, and it's becoming more and more crowded.
Chris?
Well, yeah, I agree. I think piracy is becoming a bigger issue than it has been in the past, and I think NATO obviously has to do something about that and tackle it and get it sorted. I completely agree with what Arrigo and Paul have said. I think another threat that, just to sort of move on, is sort of cyber. The cyber threat is becoming, well, not necessarily a maritime threat. It affects all aspects of NATO and its countries. You've got things like this, the Stuxnet virus is attacking everything. it's like a digital bunker buster, as I found. So I think it's a big thing that we need to look at.
Hmm. And I'll just add in quickly to what Paul was saying earlier. There is a growing trend for what I call regional powers to become global powers, i.e. they become powers. They're not going for superpower status, but they now have the capability to project their power in significant capability globally rather than just in their region. And if you look at Brazil, Australia with its Canberra class, the Indians, of course, and the Chinese growing carrier battle groups, and Russia's stated aims. This does seem to be what they are aiming for. They don't seem to be perhaps aiming for superpower status in my mind again, but definitely global power, and to have that global reach to defend their interests.
But just sort of follow on from that, with the cyber threat, if you haven't got the finances, especially with the austerity that we have, the cyber is quite a fairly cheap, effective option to go for, where you can attack multiple areas without having to create battle groups or man ships or whatever, but you can still have that capability, that reach, as you put it.
I think Arrigo.
Cyber threat is such a big threat for naval security. You just unplug your platform from the net, you cannot engage them. What I am fearing is too much concern on cyber threat, too little concern on the broader electronic warfare spectrum. Because, yeah, everyone is concerned on Stuxnet, on virus, on everything coming from the computer, but all platforms are depending on sensor, and those sensors can be blocked by very cheap CHAP, anti-radar missile, and all those quite old tricks are becoming less and less interesting for people to spend money on than cyber warfare. But if you look at what Chinese Navy, quite without emerging Navy, is doing, they are investing a lot of money in electronic warfare platform. I think cyber warfare right now is just a way for people to take money from government and to people to use nice word without following with real concept and real idea.
I have a feeling Paul wants to say something now, yeah, but I can't see his video.
No, I was just thinking. I think I don't know where you balance these out. I do think. I mean, certainly in the case of the UK, and I agree with Chris's point. Cyber warfare. We've seen examples of it, but it hasn't really been used extensively. I mean, there are specific examples. I think back at the beginning of this millennium, Estonia witnessed pretty severe attack on their national assets through sort of a soft attack on their systems. But I do, funnily enough, I think Arrigo has raised a very, very important point. And, of course, one of the where a lot of this expertise exists for purely exploitation of the whole electromagnetic spectrum, i.e. electronic warfare, one of the exemplars of this form of warfare was the old Soviet Union. Now, that knowledge will not have gone away. That knowledge is deeply embedded, I suspect, in various aspects of their armed forces. And I think I agree that it becomes like the throwaway cheap weapon. A pod of chaff is actually relatively cheap, and it always was, and it won't have got any more expensive now. So I think these are some of, and it's an example, if I may add this, of where we have let basic maritime warfare skills wither a little bit because we're not engaged or have not been engaged for the last 15, 20 years, which is, let's face it, a generation of military people, of sailors, in keeping up very basic maritime warfare skills, such as electronic warfare, such as anti-submarine warfare. We've been distracted, quite rightly, in my view, into dealing with what are known as sort of low-level threats, such as piracy and supporting land operations, sort of almost sitting on the sidelines of them in some ways, and it's taken the back seat. And so I think the combination of, we're moving slightly into, have we let these things go a bit, but this is a good entry point that we have let go some of these skills. They could be relearned, but you need a strategy to decide to relearn them and apply them. And I do think electronic warfare for a smaller nation, a less sophisticated nation, is a cheap way of causing a lot of confusion, a lot of deception, and so forth and so on, which is what, of course, electronic warfare is all about.
And, of course, this is the sort of debate that's going on at the moment between, if you look at America, between the advocates of the E-18 Super Growler, possibly the coolest named aircraft currently serving, Super Growler, let's be honest, that's a really cool name, and the Joint Strike Fighter, one side, of course, going for very high-tech stealth, and the other side saying, well, no, we have electronic attack or jamming as our methodology, and it's actually cheaper. And this is a debate which I think in many Western powers, and this will lead into, I hope, as you're saying, into the have we cut too much question, it's very attractive to go for the ultimate supreme high tech. You know, the gold-plated super system is very attractive, and there are reasons for this. In my own view, I would often put forward the fact that when you've got treasuries which are very keen on cutting and getting a finite amount of money, it's very tempting to use that money to build the best ship you can, because then you can deal with all situations, rather than build possibly the less capable ship you can use at the moment, planning to upgrade it when you need to upgrade it for a more risky problem, because you're not sure whether you're going to get the money when you need it to upgrade it. And if you can still build the small cadre of high-intensity warships, you would need to back up those ships. And so let's get into this if no one wants to add. Does anyone want to add any more before we get on to the question of have we cut too far?
Nope.
Okay, so let's say, have we cut too far? Who wants to go first? Arrigo?
I think we have cut too far. You have made a very interesting point about gold-plated high technology. Because we have been trained in school, university, and also in military academy, that technology will always be the key for future warfare, we have gone for a really, really high-end technology, very expensive, but to support this high technology, we have cut everything else. Look at what is happening in the US with cutting an entire close air support part of the Air Force fleet. Because, no, we don't need A-10. We have the Joint Strike Fighter. But they are plane doing completely different mission. Still, the idea a superior technology can solve everything has been ingrained not only in the procurement system, but also in the way of thinking of a lot of senior and middle-level officer. And with money not flowing in the old quantity, now, to preserve high technology, we are cutting everything else, leaving us with, I will not say small forces, because Western Navy are still quite big, but very brittle. We have just ship for a single operation. If something go wrong, or we start to lose a lot of ship, maybe are gone.
And I will point out, in addition to that, the Chinese Navy are currently launching about 17 warships a year, which is the same number of ships the Royal Navy has as its entire force. So, yes, and of course the Chinese certainly do not build all high-tech ships. We would, qualitatively, they wouldn't be a one-for-one match, but that odds gets problematic. Chris, before we come to Paul, because I know Paul's raring to go with something, but Chris, what do you have anything to add in?
Well, I was just going to sort of follow on from Arrigo's point and wonder whether, well, to what extent the European NATO's spending has been influenced by the fact that we do have America to back us up, and maybe governments and finance ministers are slightly reliant upon that alliance.
Yes, and which of course makes the American Indo-Pacific pivot, as I like to call it, very, very interesting from our perspective, because they're not there anymore.
Exactly.
And of course, which it was one of the recent round-the-world cruises the Royal Navy did to highlight its capabilities for going around the world, and, which is all useful for showing global presence and important, but I think on one of the trips they had a French destroyer and an American destroyer along to provide area air defense, because of course we had no carrier anymore with Harriers, and we didn't have any Type 45s at that point ready for war. So the Royal Navy didn't have any air defense vessels other than what could be provided by Seawolf armed frigates, which are, it's a Seawolf is a lovely system, a very good system, but it's not an area air defense missile, is it? And with that piece of technicality, I will let Paul open up, because I know he's got tons.
Yeah, I think, so. Well, I think the Arrigo's point is pivotal, that gold, I like it, gold-plated high technology. I totally agree with that. I think lots of people have been seduced by the salesmen from the big arms companies promising that they can do X, Y, and Z. And I'm sure, you know, they can, but it's very, very expensive. And I think, for me, the best example of an expensive system which is currently being procured, which I find very difficult to understand, is the F-35. The most expensive aircraft I think ever produced. And actually, I'm not convinced that its capabilities are commensurate with its cost.
On that point, I would say there are people who sometimes argue the Eurofighter is actually more expensive than the F-35. Well, myself, both of the cost systems seem so confusing, I can't work them out. I'm a humble historian, not an advanced accountant.
I agree. But I think the result of this gold-plated high-tech thing, which I think Arrigo is absolutely right on, is that there is a very sort of well-worn saying that quantity has its own quality. And I think that's a really important point. You know, a ship can only be in one place at a time. It can go to different places, but it can only be in one place at one time. Nobody's yet got over that that hurdle. And I think if you limit the number of hulls that you have, whatever level of technology, you are limiting your maritime capability along this sort of idea of, you know, presence is important, but to be somewhere, you've got to be somewhere to do something. That it's very simple. And I think that's been forgotten when you spend an inordinate amount of money on very high-tech systems. Now, I don't think you should spend no money on high-tech systems. I think you need to get the balance right. And I'm not sure. I think it's gone too far, the high-tech sort of route. And it's ironic, really, that actually basic hull production, forget the warfighting bit of it, is actually relatively cheap. I mean, really cheap. If you look at the sort of costs involved, you can get a lot of hulls with a lot of space in them for relatively small amounts of money. Now, I'm not advocating you go completely that way. All I'm pointing out is that it is not an impossible equation to solve. So that's one thing. And I mentioned it very briefly. I do think that we have been, all of us, have been unduly influenced by glossy salesmen from defense companies. One only has to look at the history of some of these complex high-tech systems to see that generally they come in over budget and late. And I think that's a problem. which needs to be addressed from an industrial point of view. And I think going back to where Rodriguez started, his point about the military establishment, of especially more senior people, being imbued with this view that high-tech stuff is good, I think that needs to be addressed not purely from a military perspective. I think a balance is needed, and I think there's a knock-on effect here. We've focused on high-tech at the expense of the people. In the end, whatever anybody says, it's people that win wars. That's my heartfelt view. There is a balance, of course. You can't have a man with a bow and arrow shooting at somebody who's got a strategic nuclear weapon, but that's very extreme. But there is an element of, if you don't look after the people and keep the knowledge within the organization, then you start to have problems. And that goes back to my point, if you like, where we started with electronic warfare, anti-submarine warfare. I think one of the impacts of especially European countries cutting back too much is not just in equipment terms, but in the numbers of people who embody the knowledge to fight in the maritime environment.
And before I let Irigo dive in again, because I know he's bursting to say something, I'm just going to add in a couple of nuggets of history. One, we seem to have forgotten our own lessons from the Second World War, when, if you consider the German tanks were by far the most advanced technologically and lovely systems, but the Sherman tank, which we fielded, thanks to the American factories mainly, was definitely not, and yet we won because we basically outnumbered them about a dozen to one at several points. And this is the thing, quantity does have a quality of its own, and we keep forgetting that. We keep going high technology, and unfortunately we're sort of reversing the situation. And the other point is, I always remember with systems, people, as you rightly bring up, Paul, so many systems, that especially the gold-plated revolutionary systems, the new systems, come in expensive and over budget and over late. I have to remember, I think, the last one actually such system, which I can find in history, which I feel did come in on time, on budget, and didn't have World War II pushing it through, was the HMS Dreadnought in 1905, if you could think of that. So that's how long since then no major project has come in on time or on budget. And most of them have lost both of those criteria. Arrigo.
I think you raised quite a number of interesting points. It's everything about technology and what we think about technology. You say German tanks were the most high technology piece of armored vehicle in World War II. I will say, yes, on paper they were, but Sherman was a much better all-around combat vehicle. Yeah. Theoretical performance of the Panther was much better. But it seems for every Sherman knocked out in direct combat between Panther and Sherman, at least two Panther had been knocked out by Sherman. Because there were so many defects, so many less well thought engineering part in the Panther, that often the Sherman, with better trained crew, more reliable vehicle, better ammunition, and more tank overall, were able to exploit. It's like the famous Type 93 torpedo from Japan, oxygen-based long-range torpedo. The Japanese Navy entered World War II with the idea this torpedo will create a huge success for them. Technologically speaking, it was a wonder weapon. Long, twice the range of everyone torpedo, enormous explosive warhead. The only problem was the torpedo was aimed by naked eye. So, hit ratio around 10%, if not less, in combat condition. It means a single torpedo can sunk a cruiser. But if you fire 20 torpedoes and no one hit, it's like not having them. And I fear we are concentrating too much on single weapon system. The Joint Strike Fighter is supposed to give us complete dominance over sea, air, and land. But it has never entered combat. If the system will be not as effective as it advertised now, not only we will lose a big, expensive piece of crap, but our weapon development cycle of the last 20-25 years will be compromised. Because remember, the F-35 is around in project form from late 90s.
And I'll just quickly apologize for the PG-18 word which Arrigo just used.
Sorry.
Don't worry. And I'll add in, the interesting thing I find with Joint Strike Fighter, and this is before Paul, I know, wants to say something, and Chris, both have stuff to say, is that the US Navy, the only buyer who's pretty much getting a version of the Joint Strike Fighter custom built for them, because no one else is buying the C variant, are the only ones who are actively talking that the JSF is going to be part of a team of aircraft with Super Growlers, I'm just getting that cool name in as much as possible, U-Class, their UAV system, and E-2Ds, and possibly still remaining in service Super Hornets. So this seems to be the most interesting to me, that the only group who's getting a custom-built F-35 are the ones who are almost in many ways placing the least reliance and faith in it. Now, Paul, would you like to go first, or would Chris like to go first?
I've only got one word to say, and then I'll let Chris say it, and that is Kalashnikov.
Ah. Yes, very true.
Very true indeed.
It works very well. And very scary to be shot at by it, even though you know it can't hit you. The noise just makes everyone duck. Chris?
Well, I'd just like to follow. I'd like to really look at the benefits of the cuts in many respects, if I may.
Okay.
Because I know a lot of people are going, oh, you know, we need more money and more troops and more technology. But in many respects, I think austerity will serve, hopefully, anyway, in the mid to long term, to streamline NATO, to make it more cooperative. So NATO countries have, European NATO countries have greater linking with each other rather than having this strong American dependence. So governments and militaries share their resources and their troops. I know this sounds maybe a little bit too far-fetched, but I think some more sharing, some pooling and all that sort of thing is more beneficial long-term.
I would agree with you if it works out like that. But the trouble is the lessons of history are that.
Yeah,
but
if you look at the cut, a lot of the cuts have been done in multinational formation, multinational deployment group, because every country wants to keep some share of the IGAN system for prestige reason. And also, if the complete collection of forces is an downsizing, they really are not happy to share those force with other people in joint command. So we see more common weapon project, but less common common system, less common joint formation, and sadly, more and more reliance on US for everything is not just your premier fighting in a unit.
But the trouble is, that isn't, before Chris puts in, the trouble is reliance on the US isn't practical anymore. And this is one of the reasons why I think possibly SimSec and PTT have put this series of podcasts together, because we have got the East Atlantic, the European NATO nations have started got thinking about a world where the US is not going to be as strong a presence in the Atlantic as it traditionally has been, because it's going to be in the Pacific, and it's kind of like the 1920s and 30s coming back, where the US Navy is concentrated on the Pacific, and, well, in the 1920s, of course, it didn't matter, 1930s, because there was another very large, very beautiful grey machine that dominated the Atlantic and most of the Mediterranean and the rest of the world. It flies, of course, a lovely white ensign and calls itself the Royal Navy. Unfortunately, it's not so big anymore. And this is a problem we're going to have to look at. Also, I was actually talking to someone the other day who actually said the Horizon-class frigate was the most successful joint project that the European nations have ever done, because it all, in the end, all the nations involved got what they wanted out of it. And that included the Royal Navy leaving, the British leaving the project and building their own destroyer class. this is part of the problems, I think, because each of the nations are very, very individual in what they want and what they need, because it has to fit their strategic priorities. Chris?
Well, is that the priority laid down by the government, or is it laid down by industry? I think the government, European defence companies have a very large proportion of government shareholders. So I think in many respects, I think industry is dictating to some extent some of these sort of strategic capabilities.
I happen to agree. Sorry to interject, Chris. I did hint at this earlier, and I actually feel that is the case. If I could just... I'm sorry to intervene suddenly like that.
No, by all means.
A couple of things. Horizon has been mentioned. I was actually the lead Ministry of Defence desk officer for writing the requirement for Horizon with my French colleague and Italian colleague. And I was involved in the project before the UK pulled out of it. And the blood and the sweat and the tears that went into carving out a requirement that was agreed between the three nations was enormous. But it was successful. The problem was... the trilateral meetings, which happened, stamped on my brain, this, because once a month I had to fly to Rome and once a month I had to fly to Paris for 2.5 years. And then once a month my colleagues came to me in London. And the meetings, we had two sets of meetings. One was with the requirements people from the central staffs, if you like. We were naval officers writing what we wanted to see in this ship. And we achieved a near 100% agreement on what was required. And that's without any, we had our fights about it and, some late nights and so on. But overall, we achieved a military requirement which was cohesive and agreed between the three nations. The problem was our respective procurement agencies, who were heavily influenced by two factors. One is called not invented here syndrome in each of the three countries, and the other one was a massive industrial lobby in each of the three countries, saying to their respective customers, traditional customers, we will pull the pin on this unless you buy our product for me to meet this requirement. So what Chris has said it's written on my forehead, this. And in fact, I would argue that if that project had gone ahead, it would have changed European defense procurement, because it would have forced companies to work together, and also it would have, if you like, brought about a supremacy of the requirement over what they wanted to provide for their own ends. So that's my comment on Horizon. I'll leave it for the floor. Now, I've got a couple of other things, but that was specifically I wanted to say that. Because, of course, you know, the French have shown interest in our carrier program, and so forth and so on. And I believe there is a much greater need for certainly European coming together, if you like, at the political, military level. And the whip has to be cracked to a certain extent with these very, very powerful industrial lobbies.
And just before we carry on, I'd just like to put this point out there. If the Horizon frigate had carried on, it would have been a European project like the Eurofighter. And we've all seen how difficult it has been to cut those numbers when the cuts, the budget cuts, etc. came in. So might the Horizon frigate numbers have survived better than the Type 45 numbers, and so might the Royal Navy not have more escorts than it does now, which would, of course, be a very interesting possibility to consider. Mm. And the other point is, and this was raised by a friend of mine called Dan Lewis, who runs an economic website, an economist, when he first heard about the Mistrals being built by the French for the Russian Navy, he said, in the recent crisis, why couldn't they be bought and sort of bought for the British Navy? Why couldn't the Royal Navy take them on as ocean illustrious replacements? And when I was listening to it, I was thinking, well, it might not happen, but an LHD class is something all navies in Europe could theoretically use. Mm-hmm. You know, might that be the next great big cooperation? Anyway, Arrigo and Chris, you seem to, you're both looking at me with points, so whichever one speaks first gets to go first.
After, let Arrigo go first.
Okay. I think you have, as usual, nailed a very interesting point. What we do with the Mistral, and you cannot cut big European project because it's political prestige involved.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's very easy to cut national project because you don't look anti-European. And there is also another point where never discussing, sometime talking peripherally about it. When we procure a new weapon system, when we decide to cut an existing or a projected weapon system, why we are doing it? Is for prestige or for rational requirement? Paul told us at a certain point the Horizon class project was created for specific military requirements. This is really good, but we are talking of so much long-term program, even simple thing like a fighter, now take 20, 30 years. Mm. When you first make your requirement, you have some idea. When the system enter in service, the world has changed. One of the problem of the Joint Strike Fighter is they are constantly changing electronics, weaponry, because everything else is changing. And, but still, we are making a lot of assumptions. European or US or the West will always save superiority. Our technology will always be the best. We will never got a lot of losses. Everything is based on theoretical assumption, yeah. Often made more by convenience than real world data. And, then carrying on those assumptions for 20, 30, 40 years, never changing. When they first designed the Eurofighter, it was the most advanced fighter in history. Mm. And was doing what was supposed to do really, really well. Actually, we are quite lucky to have the Eurofighter now, because probably there will be the need for a high performance, high maneuver fighter if something go bad with Russia. Joint Strike Fighter was designed to operate in relatively safe environment to deliver single precision bomb on specific fixed target.
Yep.
But now, things are changing again. We can go back to a more 1970, 1980 environment where we really need a lot of cheaper plane with a lot of ordnance just spread out over large area. We never know when our system will enter in service, and if all requirements made on day one will be relevant to day X.
And does this bring us to the 3D printing scenario, of course, with the fact that the development cycle is now so long, is it become to the point where with 3D, we have to develop 3D printers to the point that they can just produce UAVs overnight, and so we no longer have to worry about development cycles taking 20 years. We can just design it and build it next day, and if it fails, just design and build a new one. That'd be cool. Anyway, Chris.
What I'm very interested by this Eurofighter, Joint Strike Fighter debate, really, I think it shows an element of standardization. And in my opinion, talking as a strategist, and not specifically a maritime strategist, but I think that's a step forward. I can't understand, looking at a graph that I found, I can't understand why the European market has 29 types of destroyers and frigates, whereas America has 4. Yeah. Europe has 15 types of torpedoes, America has 2. I think we need to get these numbers down, create some more standard systems that we can share and integrate, and create more cooperative forces. I think Arrigo's looking at me as if I'm talking mad, but that's just my opinion.
No, you are quite right, but for the reason we have already debated earlier, probably it will never happen because there is too much interest and too much national prestige involved.
But surely NATO's common policy, common strategic aims, have got to be very similar.
I would just ask this question. When was NATO set up?
1949.
Yes. And that is now how many years ago? Nearly 65 years ago. And it still hasn't managed to achieve standardization between its nations. And they have been trying it for 65 years.
That is true. But we are now facing an extreme era of austerity.
Yes.
More so than we have for quite a long time. You have to consider the period you're talking about, Alexander, is the Cold War, where you've got a lot of spending, you've got a lot of American dominance of NATO. Now we're sort of looking at a European standalone, like you said, we've got America looking at its own problems. If the European military, for a better term, is going to stand on its own, then maybe it has to throw aside some of this prestige issues and just to knuckle down and say, right, we have to look at our own situation.
Yeah, Chris, I have to say, I come in there. The word that comes to mind for me is specialization. And it's a swear word when you're talking politics, because it means, as Rodriguez quite rightly has pointed out, you know, everybody wants a bit of the action. Now, here's a hypothesis for you. If one were to agree in Europe, and this is primarily a political question, that not every nation can do everything, then you have to look towards some form of specialization. And let me give you, for me, in the maritime arena, it's relatively simple. There are probably, three biggish nations in Europe who could quite easily take the lead in maritime affairs. One would be Italy, second one would be France, and these not in order of priority, and the third one would be clearly the only major power that sits on an island, which is the UK. And I think that if those three nations, a la Horizon, could cooperate in the maritime arena, I do not see why we could not field three or four strike carrier battle groups quite easily. But in the UK, the sacrifice would be, and I can only speak from a UK perspective, would have to be that we agree not to have as big an army. Because actually, you don't need a big army on an island. In that sense, if you agree that other nations who are continental nations should take up the slack on the army side. So I'm putting that up as a bit of a sort of coconut shy, but that actually, if you went along that route, all the good work that's been done by NATO over 65 years on writing standards, and there are libraries and libraries of them, actually could be very quickly consolidated when you say, right, we want four or five strike carriers, we've already got a French one, we've got a couple of British ones, we need another couple, and then you build your task groups around that, and you say, we want so many of that class of ship and so many of that class of ship, and you have to have agreement up front that the three nations or other nations who want to contribute in the maritime area just buy them off the shelf, and you tailor your cloth accordingly. Shoot me down.
I'd love to. It all makes sense. And Chris, before we talk about austerity, remember in the 1960s, the Royal Navy had its carriers cut because we were going through an economic crisis. They were focusing, like Paul has just said, on actually the land forces and the British commitment to the army sitting in Germany. And interesting enough, at the time, they sold the army in Germany as being like Britain's forward deployed carrier in Europe to cut the carriers we were building to fight in the rest of the world. I love British defence politics. It's beautiful, some of the things in it. Arrigo, what do you think of that, of the Italian Navy being the other third major marine power? And I have noticed a huge smile on your face.
Actually, at the moment, we are a huge maritime power.
Yeah.
With operational carrier, destroyer, flagger, a good replacement program.
Yeah.
Quite well trained crew. Lot of operational time, we are up everywhere in the world, but for how long we can sustain this, before there is already some politician who say, oh, we have two carriers, we can just sell one to Angola.
Mm.
And they want to sell the Garibaldi to Angola. Or simply, why we need such a big war fleet if we are a member of NATO? One interesting thing about NATO integration is by second half of the 80s, it was working. Countries were specialized. There was a quite good coordination, integration with standing naval group, specific country providing specific capabilities mine countermeasure, Italy, Royal Navy, and I think Denmark.
Yes.
Like this, the surface strike with Germany, Italy, and in part France. But this instrument was designed to fight a single engagement. Mm. The big war for West Germany and Europe. In this framework, expanding the British Army of the Rhine was a quite good move. For NATO was really important. We had plenty of ships. The Royal Netherlands Navy at the time was quite big.
Yep.
France, US, still Canada at the time. Even Italy was quite strong. But we need more and more tank and artillery and infantrymen in Germany to make sure we were not losing the Central Front.
Mm.
At least just for the big war in Germany. After the wall came down, we all end up Alexander said, fighting everywhere in the world. And if you are fighting everywhere in the world, first of all, carriers are much better than a full British Army of the Rhine. You can move. You cannot move. And also, because you are fighting for your own interest, you cannot rely so much on close integration with everyone else. Because your expeditionary warfare maybe is not what your big partner want to do. UK has always helped the US, but look at France. Sometime has gone, sometime not. Germany. All the German armed forces have been a waste of money because they contributed really little to multinational operation.
Mm.
The German government always refrained to be too much engaged, and when they were sending troops, often they were just avoiding fighting. Yeah, integration is important, but if we are looking to a single threat, everyone agree it's quite good. If we are looking at something you need to do on your own, you need balanced forces. And this is the downside of close integration.
Chris, because we haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, I was just going back to my point. I all the reports I've read have advocated total integration, consolidation, if Europeans to survive. Now, I'd just like to touch on a slightly non-maritime issue, if I may, of Afghanistan, which is far removed from anything, but has shown a lot of NATO integration, shown a lot of cooperation, and maybe okay, I know it's had its problems, but maybe some of the lessons from that could be employed in a wider process. Would that be possible?
Yes, I'm sure it would be. I have a particular problem about Afghanistan that it's nowhere near the North Atlantic, but that's an aside.
I was using it as a contextual.
I agree. I understand. I think any joint experience, joint and combined experience, needs to be captured and it needs to be implemented. I don't have a problem with that. And I have to say, I think this is a very central political issue in Europe in particular, because there is this sort of divergence of views between, and funnily enough, it's all to do with this sort of, the Americans have been here to help us for a long time, and now it looks as if we may have to stand on a little bit more on our own, and the reluctance amongst European powers to really integrate politically. Now, that's a very, very heavy political point, but as Rodriguez has highlighted, whilst European countries have their own interests, now more globally or certainly regionally, it's going to be very difficult to focus attention into some sort of unified NATO slant European force. I think that is a real challenge, unless, of course, the problems with Russia start to get out of hand.
Ooh, that is, of course, a big question, and
yeah, it's a separate subject,
but also there are 2 points I would like to make. I would wonder what Felix would say after having heard Arrigo's description of the German army. Felix is one of the other speakers who unfortunately couldn't be with us this evening, but he's usually going to be a part of the panel. And the other one is, it really does add to the thing when you consider the political dimensions of the French sales and the extent they've gone to still keep selling the Mistral class to the Russians. And the fact that they haven't just sold ships, and this is what often people misunderstand, they think just about the two ships the French are building. The French have actually sold them the plans and trained them to build two more ships in Russia. Now, how could France stop them if the Russians decided to build more than two more ships? If they decided to build four more or six more? I'm not saying Putin is so inclined, but the man is very much, as Arrigo described him, an adventurer, in that he is going on and he's gambling on every time he's making sort of a strategic gamble, gambling that the politicians that we have currently will not stand up to him in any meaningful way. So he can just keep succeeding. And the more he succeeds, the more confident he's going to get, and the more likely he is to gamble more. And this surely is a worrying factor and takes us back to the threats. So considering that deal a couple of times with points Arrigo had made, I'm going to let him continue from there because he's also got to make up for being rude about the German army.
I think I am not rude with the German army, but I am rude with the German government.
Yeah.
And the idea, we have a big army in Europe, now not so big anymore, but in the end, we have never been able to use it to further European foreign goal. And you raised the point of Russia. It's interesting, because Russian military is probably getting much better equipment and doctrine than us. If you look at what they have done in the past 10, 15 years, it has been studying what we are doing and devising a cheap and effective way to counteract what we are doing. They have much more artillery, unguided artillery in their brigade than NATO equivalent. Okay, there are people from Rusi telling us it's just iron bomb, iron artillery, it will never hit anything. But the problem is artillery is not designed to hit single target. It's designed to saturate a wall box and making us not doing thing in this wall box we wanted to do. On the naval side, they are not building the super ship doing everything, including tea and coffee. But they are designing AIG technology for them, and also for us, platform designed usually to kill our carrier. Maybe they will not work. Hopefully, they will not work. Maybe they will work, but still, we have to divert a lot of our resources just to face the Russian Navy. And everything we have done in the past 25 years has been made on the assumption we will have complete control of the sea. Recently, I was doing some simulation testing, and in one of the tests, a single Chinese plane dropped a single anti-ship missile, was sunk a full Aegis destroyer before open warfare started. It was a really, really extreme occurrence. Just luck. But after this event, the entire Japanese strategy in the test was preserving his high-value ship to avoid a repetition of a disaster. If we lose a single destroyer against a single Russian platform, be it a plane, a submarine, or a surface ship, probably our entire maritime strategy will be sent to the shelf, and something new will be crafted, probably very conservative. And again, we are going to the point, we have cut too much, because our platform are really, really powerful, but we don't have any of them, and probably the fact we cannot deploy constantly so many of them, like how many carrier UK need, how many carrier US or even Italy need, because once the politician buy a ship, they think we buy the carrier, it will be always operating. As it has been pointed out several times, to have a single carrier always available, you need at least two, better three. But if your high-end platform, your critical platform, not just about in technology, but in capabilities, will be sunk or will be rendered ineffective, our entire maritime strategy will be made irrelevant. And yeah, everything need on. What we need, and everything in the end is resting on a single point. What we need a navy for.
Yes, very true, Rigo. And it is what I always point out to people, when, especially when politicians ask me this question of, we have the ship, so it must be available. Well, no. You need three to guarantee it's going to be available. Two, it's a bit of hope and luck, which, as you say, is actually a far bigger factor in warfare than many would ever like to admit. Even modern high-precision warfare, there's still luck in it. And if you want to guarantee one's available for forward deployment, you need four, which, if you think, the politicians should understand, because that's what they get when they buy the strategic deterrent. They buy multiples of four, because that guarantees the one at sea, whatever happens. And this is what it seems to me in a lot of funding battles. Again, they forget. They go, oh, we are buying 200 aircraft. Well, you're not. You're buying, actually, possibly the ability to deploy 80 aircraft, because some of those aircraft are going to be wrecked in training. that you're going to have attritional losses, even of the beautiful F-35 or the Eurofighter. There is going to be attritional losses of them in training. I'm sorry, there is no aircraft, which is proof the idiot that sits in its cockpit. Not even a UAV, which doesn't have the idiot sitting in its cockpit. And yes, I am calling all pilots idiots there, but that's just saying, there is going to be one of them is going to be an idiot, and it's going to crash.
It's percentage.
They're going to be showing off for a girlfriend or something. And you're going to have the ones which are going to be in maintenance. You're going to have the ones which are down because the bloomin' spare you ordered hasn't come through, even though you ordered it 2 months ago because there's some sort of industrial dispute where it's being built. And so this is the thing. When you buy these systems, and with the Type 45s, classic example is no one ever justified cutting them from 8 to 6. No one ever justified that. They just did it. And it's sort of, I was watching and thinking, that doesn't make sense, because you're talking about having one of these forward deployed the whole time in the Arabian Gulf. You're talking about having one of these any every other time in the Falklands. You need 8 for that job. You need to guarantee it, so you have the 4. But now you have 6. And they've got to cover any carrier battle group, any amphibious task group, all this. We haven't got enough. Even if you put only one with each of them, you're not going to have enough to go round. You're going to have to sacrifice something. And the trouble is, the more often you sacrifice, it might not do anything the first time, but if your opponents start to realise you're sacrificing it, then they know when to make their moves, because that's when you won't be able to be there. And Paul.
Can I take up on what Rory said? I think the last question that he raised is, you know, look at the whole Navy. What do you want the Navy for? I think that's, we're opening up a complete thing, but I think this is very relevant. And it's a very important question. I mean, I can very easily answer the Cold War answer to why, we've rehearsed this slightly before, we had the NATO navies come together for, and it was basically to support the continental battle. And in fact, you know, American strike carriers coming across the Atlantic, supported by a lot of European navies, all the anti-submarine warfare effort, all that stuff was all only support for one thing, carrier strike, where carriers would sit off the north of Norway and drive deep into Russia to deal the blow that was needed, strategic engagement. So, I mean, there was a clear raison d'etre for a navy in that scenario. And I think it comes back to, you know, the question that you've raised here, what is the threat, and therefore what sort of navy as a whole do you need to counter that threat? And I think it's a very, very big subject. And the other point that I make, that I would add, is another one word answer to the question about take out the capital ship. And I'll just mention one word, and it's called Belgrano.
Yes.
And that actually put paid to a whole navy's ambitions.
Yes, after that, the Argentinian navy kept very far back. In fact, so far back, they never left port.
Exactly.
Not a good scenario. Chris, we haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, I was just interested by what Paul said about the US being supported by European navies. Mm. Now, if, the way I think of it, if we have a conflict which involves NATO, I think that's going to be the role of a lot of European countries, literally just supporting US battle groups and task forces. So maybe Britain and a few others have cut back purely because that's what they believe. They believe that there's no reason that we need to shoulder the burden too much. We've got our own financial, tightening fiscal environments, for a better phrase. We're just going to be supporting America anyway. So let them carry it. But I think
I agree,
changing.
Chris. It's a political issue, this.
It is,
It's how Europe sees itself.
And how it survives without America.
Absolutely.
Right, I'm going to say, because it's been over an hour by my watch, I'm not sure by Arrigo's, so I'm going to say, shall we sum up?
Okay.
Okay, because I don't want to take up too much of your evenings. as he's spoken least, probably, I'm going to let Chris go first. Also, because the look of torture on his face when you're saying that is pure, pure joy.
Thanks, go on, Chris. When I come back, I don't want to come across as being belligerent. I'm just sort of highlighting my views, really. I think we need a greater European defence consolidation, sharing of resources, and more communication between countries. I know there's a big question of sovereignty and a big question of prestige, but I think in a world without so much American involvement, I think that's NATO's main chance of survival and able to sustain itself if a conflict were to occur.
Paul?
Yeah, very briefly, I think the problem is political. It is Eurocentric, and it is about the perception one has of the threat to Europe. And I think some of the solutions are specialization, specialisms, and sharing in Europe.
Anna Riga.
Again, we need to define a threat. We need to define how we want to face the threat. And we need to really think about strategy, operation, together, yep, as Europe and also as US under the aegis of NATO, and ending up with a concrete plan and tailor our defense acquisition to the plan.
Right, and I will say that was a very, very interesting first panel. Thank you very much for taking part. It's been excellent. I'm Alex Clark. We're with Chris Stockdale and Paul Fisher and Arrigo. Going through quickly, any websites you want to mention? Arrigo, what do you sound on?
No website at the moment.
Okay. Paul?
I would just support the Phoenix think tank.
Thank you. Chris?
I agree. Phoenix think tank and, of course, SimSec.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm, of course, going to say the Phoenix Think Tank, SimSec. British Naval History is also excellent, and that's not just because they're putting up a couple of papers of mine. And I'll not do a plug for my own blog because I haven't put a paper on there. I've just put podcasts up recently. So take care. Thank you very much for listening, and have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.